joining us live in studio as he comes in a couple of moments. Tonight, by the way, if you are in Toronto this evening, you can catch Terry Ryan's book launch, a book that really everybody should read. Tales of a First Round Nothing. I have said before, I don't like the title, but I love the man. Tonight, the book launch at Shoeless Joe's in Toronto, downtown, 276 King Street West. All the action begins at 7 o'clock Eastern. The man, the myth, the legend, the bon vivant, the raconteur, the hockey player, the parents, the husband, the noof, Terry Ryan, live in studio. TR, it is so freaking good to see you. How you been, brother?
That's a great intro. I really enjoy that. I'm going to play that back when I get home to make myself feel good. Whenever I'm down, I'm going to play that to make myself feel good.
Well, there's plenty of praise all around. And by the way, Wish, I know you don't have a copy of the book yet. I will send you one. Page 72 is excellent. As a young broadcaster, then from CBC, now of Sportsnet, gets a nice little gratuitous mention from our man, TR. Well.
Of course.
Good to know the quid pro quo worked out. And look at you on a highly rated podcast.
To be honest with you, I couldn't have told that story if I didn't have... I tried to put things in there that a lot of people saw or experienced, because then, well, they gave more legitimacy to it. So that was one of the ones, the hot stick. I mean, me coming up with that move, no one would really believe that, especially that morning. I was there and I was showing my son, my stepson. His father was BJ Young, who played hockey with me in Red Deer. Passed away in a car accident in 2005, but whatever. I always say that because people... Yeah, I think BJ deserves his due. He's one of my best buddies. And Tyson is as much my son as Penny Lane is my daughter. I say that. But, his father, as far as the bloodline, he's a great, great, great man. And BJ and I used to do that in practice. And Aaron Asham and a bunch of us in Red Deer. We were really fun-loving guys, as if you can't tell from reading the book. And that's the kind of guys I gravitate towards, Yeah, you didn't even ask me this question. I'm just going.
That's what I love about you. See, Terry just starts freestyling. So here's what we're going to do. I thought this might be kind of neat because, Greg, you haven't read the book yet. So what we're going to do here, TR, is we're going to play Terry Ryan roulette. So I'm going to give you a couple of topics here, Greg. You let us know where the conversation should begin.
I'll start. Let's start right off the bat because this is something that I've always wanted to hear from Terry. But you are the originator of the hot stick celebration, the one that Alex Ovechkin resurrected for his 50th goal that year. What did you think of Ovi's at the time? And were you screaming from the rooftops, "Hey, man, that dude stole my move"?
I will. And so, when I was watching that day, I was with Tyson. That's what I was getting at. So we were watching TV, and I didn't even want to tell him because it sounded outlandish. I'd just become into his life after a year or so. And we're sitting there watching. I'm going, you're not going to believe this, Tyson. But BJ and I used to do that. I said, that was my idea. He came up with a few. That was one of mine. The fisherman was mine, which I did in St. John and nearly started a brawl. But later. But, this is the thing. So I, like I said, used to do that stuff. And I got to make this story somewhat short. So in Fredericton, we do that a lot. And in my mind, I'd use it at the end of practice to bring the French guys and the English guys together a little bit more. So, because there's a divide, and whether you like, I'm not saying you like each other or you hate each other or anything else, or that the coach provided that line. It's just natural, especially if some guys like Stéphane Robida at the time couldn't speak a word of English. So, so they tend to speak French. Some people say it should be an all-English dressing room. I never believe that. I think people need to be comfortable. But there's ways, So at the end of practice, we had these shootouts, and we would lighten the mood by whoever, if you scored a nice goal, or in my case, any goal, you'd do something. So that was one of the things. And doing I did the hot stick with Theo, Jose Theodore, and he loved that. Wow. So I think that's how Ovechkin found out. But the thing is, in Red Deer, to answer your earlier question, I didn't do it, I did it either to provide momentum. So if I ever did it in our own barn, I usually did it in our barn to get the fans going. And if the other team was, a lot of times it was just to do it. And if anybody didn't like it, whatever, they could have come at me. Sometimes you need a spark. Sometimes you need to piss the other team off. You know what I mean? Like if someone ran our guy, it's not always physical. Sometimes I'd score a goal and go smiling by the bench and do one of these moves. And it's whatever. Hockey's more mental than it is physical. So, Arguably, but you know, there's certainly a big mental part to play. So, you know, not only did I do it then, I used to do it after the three stars. It was every single time, and you know, it started to build momentum. When I got traded there, and Mark Maglier did at the trade deadline, and we ended up going on a crazy run, and so we won a lot of games, and you know, so and BJ ended up going from 32 or 33 goals, like you know, it's something like that, to 58. I had 35 points in the 16 games I played, and then the playoffs, I had 18 goals in 16 games. It, just to put it in perspective, those are crazy numbers, and I'm not that much of a dangler. It was go to the net, you know, and I got lucky as much as anything. You know, I've had playoffs where I don't do well at all. So, you know, but we were really riding this wave. So after all these, you know, time, but I remember this one specific time I was first star. I think Aaron Asham, actually, I know, he took a stick and he rode it around like Tiger Williams, except he had a cowboy hat on because it was the third star celebrations, right? So I believe it was BJ and it was Aaron and then it was me. And I came out and I, you know, I really made a mockery of this thing. So I put the stick down, then I threw my gloves aside, I threw my helmet off, and I kind of started warming up my hands over the stick. And as I was doing it, I had my eyes and my head down. And as I brought my head up, you know, I looked like the Undertaker from the old wrestling days. So my head, my eyes were in my head. And then finally, I was just staring at the sky and I opened my arms. And it was as if divine intervention was taking place. In other words, nothing's going to beat this. I just had 5 goals. Everybody can whatever. So, you know, like just right in the moment, I guess there was a bit of cockiness to it. You know, I was a kid. I'm not going to apologize because everybody in the building had fun. And that was it. That was the extent of it. Now, I figured, and there was no YouTube or anything on the go, so I figured, you know, that story was dead and buried in my book. But I honestly would never have put it in there if you didn't notice it because it sounds so outlandish. It's not true, right?
I remember when it happened. It was funny because I was talking to Dennis Bayak, who you had in Tri-City, and Dennis still thinks that you invented oxygen. Dennis, the play-by-play voice of the Winnipeg Jets now, great guy. And so we would sit around after Maple Leaf games. I'd sit there with Maple Leaf games. We'd, you know, tell hockey stories. And it seemed as if at least once or twice a week, there would be a Terry Ryan story that would come up. And I remember that one came up. And then I saw the hot stick celebration, the game against Tampa. And I said, damn it, I got to get Terry on the radio. It's just when I do Hockey Night Radio. I got to get Terry on because Ovechkin's faking the funk. And I do hope, by the way, TR, that Nate Ewell of College Hockey Inc. is listening right now because he listens to the podcast. Used to do media relations for the Washington Capitals. Yeah. And always, you know, would never tell me who the player was who inspired or encouraged Alexander Ovechkin to do the hot stick, because I'm guessing he didn't see that anywhere when he played in Russia. Moscow Dynamo.
It would be real fluky if, you know, because a few years before,
it's got to be Jose Tater.
And I called it the hot stick. And for a while, I don't know what it is now, but there's a brand, Gong Show Hockey. And they used to have a website, and it had player chirps or something it was called. And I saw it in there one time. It said the hot stick and explained it almost like I just explained it to you. And that was way before. And that was when I started looking in the internet whenever.
So hang on, did they have the TR from the Rebels celebration? Or did
they had me referenced in there a few times. I don't know who was in charge of it. I think the guys are from Ottawa.
Yeah, they are. They're Ottawa.
Are they? Okay, because I met a guy played in the Newfoundland League, Steve McJarrett, I think was his name is, McJanet. And he knew these guys. I don't know how you contributed to the site at the time, because it was a long time ago. We're talking at least a decade. Whenever they started, it was around then, and they did have a part there, a little segment that's a little option that said chirps or whatever it was. Or it was, they also had a guy, Jeff Circa, who I played with in Colorado. I think he played, his story, I should have put it in the book. See, he warmed up. He didn't play in the NHL. He warmed up for one game, and he'd tell that story. And I was down in the West Coast Hockey League playing with Jeff, and, you know, he's just one of those old school guys. We call him old school Circ, you know, everything. His gear was old. He didn't, you know, he drank beer. He didn't drink any water. You know, he didn't.
What, are you thirsty or dirty? Come on, son.
He obeyed. He went, you know, he ate his pregame meal at the right times and everything. He was just a real old school guy. He's a cop now in Denver. You picture this kind of guy would lay down the law, right? If this was 150 years ago, he would have been Billy the Kid. So, but anyway, he used to call it Blackwire Fever, and he'd get loaded, and he'd be calling these dudes. And I go, what are you doing, Sir? Like, it'd be at night. I'd be asleep in the room. Now, not every time, but and I'd look over. Excuse me. And Sir could be phoning people at like 2 in the morning when he rolled in. And I'd say, what the hell is that? And he'd say, I got Blackwire Fever. And that was calling people, and that's what he called it. He said, and I've never heard it from anybody else. And he said, that's what you call when you get drunk and you call the hockey boys, man. That's black wire fever. So I did see it on that site at the same time. So I don't know if anybody can go back and check or whatever, but that's the two things I remember from that. I don't think you can access it anymore.
That's pretty sweet. There's a few things I want to get to in the book here. And by the way, it is if you've ever heard Terry on the podcast or on radio shows or most recently on Primetime Sports last week, you know he's gold and the stories are fantastic. And the level of honesty blows my mind. I don't know if we're going to get to the tranny story. We'll see. I'm kind of surprised you put it in the book.
I'm kind of surprised no one brought it out yet. All these reviews, all these things. Love it or hate it. No one has brought that one up, and I can't believe it. I threw it in there thinking, this is either going to make me or break me. And no one has even brought it up. It's as if the Three Little Bears story.
All right. Welcome to the Merrick versus Wyschynski podcast, then.
I was going to say, leave it to this podcast to go straight to the trannies. I mean, that's why we're here.
I want to get to the Phil Esposito at the draft and want to talk about, Montreal camp with the baby Habs and Robida and Brad Brown and my buddy David Lang and all that. But TR?
Yes.
Did you not kind of get the impression she had a little stubble on her upper lip when you kissed her?
Look, but that's happened quite a few times and it's turned out to be a woman. So, I just guessed that women did that. Every once in a while. I knew there was some, but it didn't make me wonder until after the fact. And I thought back, and in retrospect, I said, yeah, I had to be honest with the boys. I said, that was the only hint that I had. And they pointed out that she might have had a bit of an Adam's apple, but I guess that got by me. She was dressed unbelievable, if you'd seen this, like fishnets, leather skirt, and she had fake bombs, okay?
Okay.
So how would I ever have known? I guess
that's going game seven. Like when you get the price tags, you're game seven.
Took me in the bathroom of the bar, and either I or her, whatever, I ripped off her shirt, and she had big new purchased fake bombs, fake bosoms, and so from that point, and the guys, I guess Brad Lieb was there. Brad Lieb agreed that
Brad Lieb was there. I know. Brad was Vanilla Marley's days.
Well, yes, he sent her over. It was at the Orbit Room. I was with the ball hockey team, and I went to a Marley's game with the ball hockey team. Yeah, I could name you other guys were there, but I can't. I don't want to do it. I don't know them that well. And I asked, I asked Brad, and he said, "Yeah, I don't care. Like any story like that in the book that someone didn't want, I'm not in there to sell out people." So I was like, I don't want to say this because it's going to seem like I'm making this up. And I maybe should leave it out of the book anyway. And he encouraged me. No, and that'll get me in the book and all that stuff.
Awesome.
So,
well, anyway,
sent her over. So.
You know who owns the Orbit Room is Alex Lifeson, the guitarist from Rush.
Did you play with Justin?
You know Justin? You met his son? You play hockey with him? He played the tournament a bunch of times.
No, well, I maybe did last year or something, and I don't recall. No, I think I would have remembered knowing him because I know who you're talking about. But now I didn't know that much. I mean, it wasn't the first time I'd been there, and it just seemed like everything was normal. And Brad must have picked up on this and sent her over, right? And then the weirdest part is that then we got in the cab, or got in her car, because when I ripped open her shirt and she was half naked, I said, let's get out of here, obviously. And she said, how fast can we do it? So when I walked out and I was waving at, I was waving at all the boys on the other side of the bar. I was going over to where the stairs are. They were going down. And I was waving, and the boys all started it, and they were like, this guy is crazy, because I'm sure Lieber too, but I didn't know what was going down. I just figured, what do I have to stay around here and get drunker with you guys for? So that was it, and I fell asleep in the car on the way back to the hotel in Brampton. That's where I was staying. So, if I guess technically you say tranny, but it was a shemale, and people, those are usually found in underground kind of, I'm not judging, by the way. I don't want all shemales calling in here and getting upset at TR. That's not what I'm all about here. What I'm saying is that, anything could have happened. If you're going to fall asleep with a stranger who has,
Both types of parts. And
you're
dealing with
a
couple of six-packs and a light switch.
I was thinking I'd wake up and my kidney would be gone, right? On the black market. Anyway, we get back and... And if I think at first he or she or whatever you want to call it picked up on mine not knowing it and maybe wanted to get off somehow, because I did. I said, you want to come in, and I wanted to, I think I mentioned that I had a condom. And no, I'm on my period. And I said, okay, well, you want to go option number two and see what's behind door number two. In other words, you know, give me some head. Can I say that? Can I say
sure,
that on the
podcast?
Okay. Sure. So, you know, we can say whatever you want.
So that's it. And yeah, I can't believe I just said that, but you know, who knows? But that's the story. I'm beating around the bush, and everybody, even 10-year-old, knows what I'm talking about. So that's what she said, and she did after the oil change. I brought her inside, and the boys were in there, and Paolo Musto and Tony Iannito, two guys like straight out of The Godfather. These guys, they're Italian Canadians that play on the hockey team, and they're real good guys. They own their own businesses. They have a lot of money. They roll. They take us to the nicest restaurants. They're beauty guys, but they have that, you know, Italian presence of power about them, and they're really confident guys. So when he slapped me on the sides of both cheeks, Paolo did, and he said, "Terry, that's a man, and I'll never forget it." And he looked at me, and I looked over at Tony, and he did the same thing, and the boy's jaw nearly dropped. And to be honest with you, what am I going to do at that point? I was more worried at first, you know, about, you know, what could have been going on. But I figured that the second time, you know, it's not like we moved on. We didn't round all the bases. And if nothing else, it was good. If nothing else, it was a good job. No pun intended. It was a good job.
And from that, let's talk about the draft.
Oh, wow.
because one of the great stories, I can't believe, A, you put that in the book, and then we're so forthcoming about it on the podcast. One of the great stories in the book is, you know, making the rounds, the interview rounds, your draft year. And you finally get to Tampa, and you finally get to talk to Phil Esposito.
Yeah.
Walk us through that conversation.
Well, do you want me to skip the Mike Milbury part?
No, go for it.
Okay, so that whole thing. Okay, so I went in, you know, as a lot of people know, before the draft, there's teams that might be interested. So they interview you. So, and they're all different. I actually flew down to Washington and did a couple down there, as did a lot of people. They're famous for that. And then I flew up to Toronto and met with Dallas and met with a sports psychologist. I can't remember his name. There was stuff like that going on all the time. I flew to a few other places in the same circumstances. And when you ended the draft, though, every team has a hotel room. So, you know, you pretty much do the whole same thing again, like going on a press junket or something. It's, you know, you go and you pretty much see, at least I did, I was rated pretty high. I'm guessing everybody rated in the first few rounds. I mean, you'd be silly not to interview them if you got the time to do it. And, you know, certainly a lot of others, you know, I guess after that, you probably take a bunch of people you think you're going to draft and you take them in there anyway. So a lot of people getting interviewed. The higher you were rated, I guess the more you were being grilled. So I was went into the New York Islanders. I didn't have I only had a couple left, and I remember Damon. I remember we were both on the way there.
That's Damon Lankow.
Yeah, Damon Lankow. I should say that. Yeah, so because we played on the same line in Tri Cities, and you know we were both at the beginning of the year. I think we really climbed. We were rated, but you know the year we had crazy years in our draft year. He ended up leading the league in scoring. You know, as a draft eligible player, which is an unbelievable accomplishment. So, you know, and I remember him going, just, you know what? And he looked over and he was done. He just said, "I've done this. I'm so tired of it." And we were on our way to, I think we were on our way to one of the Cowboys or something, somewhere where, you know, there was some draft promotion going on. It was a bar, and they served wings, and it was like our parents and everything were going. So we were kind of looking forward to doing that. And anyway, I remember Mike Barnett telling us that we had those because he was our agent, and was Gretzky's agent at the time. And we went in, and anyway, Lanks, I remember being really upset. I don't even know if he went into this meeting. And I went, I said, well, of course. I mean, I'd never turn it down, even though it was getting tiring, because, you know, I believe in karma, and what goes around comes around. If you start turning down interviews is when you might break your leg that night on the way to the cab, right? So I went in, and Mike Milbury, well, he wasn't in the room yet. It was a big round table, and you know, there were scouts on both sides, and the heads of each table were open, the chairs there. So I sat at one, and the scouts were really stroking me. They were telling me, you know, how good I was and all my attributes. They didn't really say much bad. And then, you know, it was almost like a cartoon of exactly what you would think to happen, because you hear about Mike Milbury, and yeah, you know, he didn't seem like that bad of a guy to me. I've heard crazier things. It's just like if anybody's going to walk in and be negative all of a sudden, you'd figure it would be him, right? So you could hear him walking up in the adjoining room, hear his footsteps coming. Finally, he appears in the doorway, and he walks in from the adjoining room. So now it goes silence. And he says, you know, says a few things I don't remember at first, just small talk. And then he says, well, you know, I think you skate faster with the puck than without it. And I said, I said, you know, I don't know if that's a bad thing. I hope it's okay. And then I didn't really know what he was getting at. So then he says, well, you and Lankow, it's a good thing that you played with Damon Lankow, because I don't know if you would have had all those points. And I said, well, it's a good thing Damon played with me. He led the league, and I had 60 assists this year. I'm not chopped liver. And I had a laugh. And I remember some people were some people were laughing and some were upset at this point that I was kind of talking back. And then he said, well, you know, I thought it was Bielak, I think, but it was someone tough. And, you know, it was either Bielak or Rocky Thompson or someone, or Brett Myers, someone like that. He said, you know, if you fight that guy another 10 times, you wouldn't win one of them. And I said, well, and I don't recall beating, even the Bielak, I think the Bielak fight's on YouTube. You know, we went pretty even. I wasn't beating these guys. I was hanging in there, though. I could really hang in there. If I didn't get knocked down, I knew I'd get a bunch of punches in. And I could take a punch. If it was anything to my fighting, that's what it was. It was to get a rise out of the crowd. Usually when the fight was over, people were cheering. And, you know, at least I did. I gave an effort that way, and I could take a punch. I really don't recall many times hitting a guy once and him going down. You know, most of the guys I was fighting were tougher, and they had harder punches than I did. So I was happy with my fight with Bielak. You be the judge. Go to YouTube and you be the judge. So he says that, and I said, well, you know, all I know is that I did well this time, and, you know, I'm not going to worry about future fights that don't exist. You know, this is the summertime. And I said something else. And I said, you know, you're picking number one. And I know I'm not going there. And I said, you're picking number 27. And I sure as F know I'm not going there. So I said, like, I'm falling somewhere comfortably in the middle here. So I don't really think I'm your guy. And he says, okay, tough guy. He says, you're in Tri-Cities and you're with one of your buddies there. And he says, you're out at the bar. And I say, we don't go to the bar. And this was true at the time. You can't. Tri-Cities is like lockdown, man. You got to be 21 to get into the bar. And, you know, so you're forced to kind of hang out. Just good camaraderie with the team. But there was never that, unless you snuck a beer at Applebee's. You were never getting into the bar. It was just too small a place. They knew the guys on the team. And you got to be 21. Whereas in Red Deer, you had to be 18. So it was a totally different culture where I played, you know, my last year. So anyway, he says, you know, and you've been wheeling these girls all night. And he says, finally, you take this one back, and you finally got her going, and all the boys have done their thing, and they've gone home, and this girl's been stringing you along all night. So he says, you know, she's over on the couch, and it's 10 minutes to 11, but your curfew's at 11. He said, it's a 10-minute drive home. And so, you know, I remember working it out and thinking, oh, so I don't really have time to bang her. And he says, so, you know, so you're sitting there, it's 10 to 11, you got a 10-minute drive home, and she spreads her legs and says, you know, come get me, Terry. Come F me, Terry. That's what he said. And I said, he says, what do you do? So I said, well, Mike, and up to that point I was calling him Mr. Milbury. I said, well, Mike, and I took a sip of water so as to build the suspense. And I said, I F her for 5 minutes and then I speed home. And one half, like, I remember half the people in there were laughing and the other
what
half just
put Mike Milbury do with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, what did Milbury do?
The message, I don't recall exactly. The message was get out. That was the last question that was. So I'd love to say, I'd love to say he said, get the F out of here, but I wish he did, because it would be a better story, but I can't remember. I just know he was disgusted. That was the last question. He might even have laughed. I don't know. It was definitely the last question, and he told me to be on my way, and when I got up and went to the door, I didn't realize Phil Esposito was just walking in, because he was actually my last interview. So Esposito thought that answer was real funny. He must have heard it. So he said, come on with
Shock.
Me. Yeah, yeah. He loved it. He loved it. So he said, come on with me. And we went over to his room. And I remember Tony Esposito being in there. So he must have been with Tampa at the time. And I think I remember, I never tell this part of the story, but I think I remember Scotty Bowman's brother being in there. And I don't know what his name was. I can't remember, but he looked just like Scotty Bowman. If Scotty Bowman has a brother that looks just like him named Jack or something like that, then he was in there too. Because I never really bring that up. But I remember being overwhelmed by this point, right? Because I'm in this room and then Phil's in there. And there was beers in there. There was like chips and all. There was all that. And I think it was for the scouts. And I was just, I grabbed one anyway. So he says to me, you know, I got one question for you. And he said, how far apart does Napoleon sleep from his wife? And I said, a bone apart, Phil. And he thought that was great. And I snagged a beer from the thing and I popped it. I don't know if I was supposed to or not, like, because he kind of just didn't say anything. And then he said, look, I really like your attitude. But he said, we're picking a little too high for you. We like your buddy Damon Lankow. What can you tell me about him? And I said, look, you know, he's a really good person. And he said, look, just be honest with me. You know, what's he like? And I said, well, he's got a lot of character. He's one of my best buddies. I know his girlfriend, like they're in high school, they're still married now, actually, so I guess that paid off. But I said, you know, she seems real nice. I don't know, he's honest, and he stuck up for me every time out there. And, you know, once or twice, I saw Damon put his body on the line for people when he didn't have to, you know, so, and I was being sarcastic once or twice. And he said, that's all I needed to know. He said, that's exactly what I thought, but sometimes you got to talk to the inside to understand. And he ended up picking Damon. That's why I think those processes are definitely worth it, because I had some good insight on it. But anyway, that's
so
the story.
Wait, so is this how they used to do things before possession stats? They would talk about character.
I know.
And girlfriends and things like that.
I know. If those kind of, all of those particular stats were around back then, I'm telling you, there's no way I would have gone 8th overall. I think there's a lot to be said for determination and everything. And I'll say this before, and I'll say it again. If you think about it, look at the guys in my era that came out of the Western League, which was considered the best league. I'm not saying that all hockey was revolving around it, but Kamloops, when I was there, won 3 out of 4 Memorial Cups. And the Western League in general, when I don't remember after. I know Zenith Komarniski, I think, won one with Spokane after, and I think Portland won one with Mike Hurley. I know Portland won with Mike Hurley. It's in the book. So that was, and that's Marion Hossa was there, Brandon, yep, Moore. So they won a lot in the 90s. You know, it was a great league to go to, and everybody coming out of there was getting drafted. And that was before the rules of obstruction and all that stuff and the new rules. It was before the one-piece sticks, which made, you know, everybody can toe drag easier because the sticks lighter. But just think about it. If you take myself out of the mix or in the mix, whatever you want to say, but I'll say, here are some of the better players in the West. Daryl McGinley. You got Lankow. It was a lot tougher than people think. Yeah. You know, Shane Doan, Zdeno Chara, Sheldon Surrey, Brian McCabe, Clark Wilm. You know, these Ryan Smith. What's, you know, and look at how successful Ryan Smith was in his career. And in today's game coming out, I don't know if he'd be given the same credit or the same attention. And that's an example of what determination and heart can get you. And that's what separates us in Canada. So I don't know why people aren't embracing it. Because look at the women's game in the Olympics this year. You know, look at their heart, and something happened in that game that we won, something. And that something is the, you know, the X factor that Canadians have, and they have it because hockey's part of our blood. And that's why you take a Canadian. And the more we get into these stats and, you know, who goes offsides more and who ties their skates this way, that's the more we're getting away from the Canadian game. And if the people running it don't realize that, then we got a problem.
Well, you see, that's a very good point. As an American, I agree with you, because essentially part of our makeup is if we show up, we win. Yeah. And that's how we thought things were going to go in that game. But lo and behold, it didn't turn out that way.
Well, exactly. And you know what else? By extension, the NHL is identified like that, too. And if we're start going to go, like, look, I'm pro-fighting, but whatever. If all the players decided to vote, you know, and there was 30% wanted fighting, I'd change my mind, too. I'm not a total idiot that's going to sit here and be a barbarian my whole life. I think it's a better game. And right now, if you ask the players, the vast majority will say yes. But let's go beyond Canada, and let's just say the NHL in general, which is identified, you know, largely by not Canadians or Americans, or it transcends countries. It's the players in the world that want to have some balls and play. You know, Alexander Ovechkin is proud that he plays in this league. And I hope after the Olympics, he doesn't give a shit about the KHL, because I think he was slapped across the face. But those people come. A lot of people don't. A lot of people don't because they don't want to play in our league. A lot of people in Sweden stay there and they make money over there. You know, people don't realize that. Not every single player wants to play in the NHL. The players that do, even the players that don't drop their gloves, there's a price to pay. They know they're coming over here. They know they're coming out of their sweet spot. They're coming out of their hometowns and they want to play. And that goes for every European, even the ones that throw snow. You know, and on top of all that, I will say Peter Forsberg is one of the most toughest players I've ever seen. Some come over and adapt, you know, and by tough, I don't mean dropping the gloves. I mean, you know, he spoke for always team first. Every interview was team first, in the corner first, tenacious. If he didn't play like that, there's no way he would have had all those points. It's a catch-22 because his career got cut short early because of it. But I have more respect for guys like that, you know, and I think that we have to understand the way our game is identified in the NHL, for anybody outside looking in, is defined by that stuff. The only difference is, you know, there's only slight differences, and the differences in our way, a lot of them are physical and physicality. And I think we're just, and now there's no red line. And can I say one more thing?
By all means.
I want to make an observation. I always see that this is the age-old debate, but I'll say something I should have said in the book more. I think I touch on it. But so the red line comes out. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you can't, I'll tell you something a lot of people don't talk about when the hooking and holding happen, like, because I'm still playing senior hockey and I find I get smoked. You know, I was playing a higher brand of hockey, a bit of hockey away. But, you know, like Scott Stevens, I just knew not to go into the middle. But that's here and there. So, you know, I used to come back in my own zone and you'd be holding up your winger so he didn't hit the defenseman. This is a penalty now, but nothing was bad was happening. The defenseman wasn't getting hit. Not only did the defenseman not get hit hard, but I knew my bearings. I didn't have to look. I could be looking the other way. I know where my guy is. And if you look at old tapes, that's what people would do. They're using like a blind man using a stick. Like you're looking at when I feel shin pads. Now you can't do that at all. So now you got people just going, and so you can't hold up your guy. They're going faster. Then you've got no red line. So a guy like Ovechkin, for example, I use him again because he's fast and when he's on, he's fast. But, you know, if there was a red line, he'd have to change it. But he just goes for a swoop. If he doesn't get the puck, he'll come back and go for a swoop. If he doesn't get it, now, if I'm one of those swoops, I get the puck and it bounces to me, he's going to knock me in tomorrow. And a lot of them are clean by the definition of they're clean, but people are just going so fast. And the other thing that, you know, in the NHL, if you're going to do this, and I can't, I'd rather just go back to the old rules, but if you're going to do it, I think you could expand the ice a bit, because here we are growing. Look at every other sport. Look at soccer, look at baseball, look at basketball, look at whatever. There's a small field. If you start on soccer, you use a small field and you go to a big field. If you play right now in Canada, you go from novice, so a dangler and Adam is real. That's why a lot of people go, you know, some guys lose it. Well, some guys run out of room. Some guys are great in Pee-wee and Adam because they have so much room and they're good skaters and they're good everything. And then sometimes Johnny gets the junior nowadays, and Johnny's the same player, but he's running out of room because everybody's big and there's no plexiglass anymore. It's cement going around the ice. Basically, you know, the boards are like cement. So now you've got a guy coming across the middle, gets hit in junior, concussed, a career's over before it began, and it could have all been avoided if we just left it in and let people play like they want to play.
Two things on that. One, I don't disagree with you. I think the rink should be expanded. I don't like the 200 by 100, Terry. I think there's too many rays you can hide on the ice, and too much of that cycle game down low is not my bag of tricks. But I will go finish style. So instead of 200 by 100, you go 200 by either 92 or 94.
Yeah.
Just a little
Something.
Bit more room on the outside.
Just a little more. Then I think cool you with. Could leave this stuff in. If you truly want to go with these rules, I do think you could make the ice bigger, and then we'll go from there. I'm not saying, you know, let's go back and be barbarians, but you just can't lose all that time of you know, kind of holding people up.
You bring up an essential point that I always bring up about my hockey fandom, which is that I'm a fan of the NHL. Like, there are other people that are fans of different levels of hockey. There are people that are fans of international hockey, like the Olympics better, all that stuff. Like, I grew up with NHL hockey and the physicality of it and the brutality of it. That's the product that I like. And I always find it an interesting debate when people point to other leagues and try to bring in rules that kind of water down the product a little bit in my eyes or get us off the brutality of the game, expand the ice, decrease the violence, that kind of thing, because essentially this is the thing that I like, and any variation of this thing that isn't this thing that I like, I'm not going to like it as much.
Yeah, I hear you. That's kind of that's what I'm getting at. And I think you know, you can't kind of always have your cake and eat it too. I hate that saying, because you can have your cake and eat it too, and that's what I want. I want my cake and I want to eat it too. But in this case, I just think there's too much, you know, one way and not enough give the other. And like I said, I'm all for improving the game and moving. I hope fighting stays in on some level. I think the way we're treating it now, and, you know, with all these cameras, the Paros thing happened at the beginning of the year, that was bad. Anytime there's anything bad, it really speaks louder than, like, no one ever shows, well, they do, but, you know, in the public's eye, no one ever says, oh, and look at this crazy event, 9 fights in a row that were good fights and no one got hurt. You're not going to see that. You're not going to see 999 in a row, no one got hurt. There's no, what they do is, you know, the next big story will be when someone, gets hit. And meanwhile, these hits are going on and people are blindsided and they're just getting corked. And, you know, when you can't do anything about it, by the way, remember a few months ago, who was it Orpik hit? Orpik hit someone over on the wall. And
Jonathan Toews hit Orpik.
When Thornton went at him.
Oh, yeah.
Erickson.
Louis Erickson.
Yeah. Well, I got to be honest, man. No one, when I was ever on the ice, I can't say ever, would do, like, I thought Orpik's was way worse. I was going, oh my, if I'm Erickson and I ever play again, I'm going to go and take that guy's, like, that's the thing. That's about me. I don't blame Montreal in every way that I fought. A lot of people think that's never part of it. I would have, and that was the, like, it, that was where, that was my fault. I'd jump off the bench in that case. I couldn't, if I was his teammate, I can see why Thornton was thinking that. And maybe it's because we're both old school. We played on the same line for a year in St. John's. But, oh my God, like, I know what Thornton did looked bad, whatever, but, like, Orpik thought about it. He looked. The puck wasn't there yet. I don't know. The way I remember this is, and this is months ago, so maybe I'm slightly wrong. I remember the puck coming. Erickson didn't even have it yet. Now, and Orpik hammered him.
Like, but Terry, he's coming out of his own zone. He's about to take a pass, and he's looking backwards.
Yeah, like but it just wouldn't happen.
You played hockey. Don't do that, Terry.
No, I know. That's what I mean. Something about it now, and maybe you do it because you're not scared anymore. So I don't know what it is. But I find lots of hits. Did you watch the Chicago game the other night? Was it the Chicago game?
Tons of hits in that one. The Seabrook on Backus?
Yeah, a lot of them, like, I guess under the rules are legal. So I just find people are getting hit way, way, way harder.
Because, what you brought up earlier, the genie's out of the bottle, the game is too fast to be safe. The example, Terry, that I always bring up, and people on this podcast are sick of it. If I told you, Terry, from the moment you walk out that door until the end of your life, whenever you park your car, you have to be going 55 miles an hour. Eventually, you're going to learn how to do it, but how many cars are you going to wreck along the way?
Yeah.
And that's just the cost of business. That's the cost of, we want this game at this tempo.
And if people are okay, the other thing is, if people are okay with it, like if I was 18, I'd still go for it because, you know, you want to make it and everything. I just think it's more dangerous like this. But if people are okay with it, I guess, you know, whatever. In the NFL, with these hits, like even with the, you know, back in the day, I mean, it's not like we were, and I hate that back in the day, like I'm an old papa, you know, just chewing.
We used to have to ice skate uphill to get to the game.
Like I'm chewing on a piece of grass and there's tumbleweed going across the highway and I'm just sitting there with my bottle of bourbon. I used to be there, boys, back in the day.
There's a tough game.
I know there was a lot of big hits. If you look at the Scott Stevens hits, they were crazy. But another argument, I guess, that I know you guys, like, Scott Stevens, you really think that he wouldn't be suspended for all of those hits? The Scott Stevens top 10 hits, that famous clip.
The majority of them.
So what happens then? So what, but it's just that he was the best at it and, you know, you didn't really raise any questions. And if you went into that area, you kind of had to have the puck already. There wasn't a lot of people, at least, you know, I just see the game in weird little clips, right? So I don't know if this is good or bad, but I find with Stevens, it was a lot of people that already had the puck and they went into the wrong area. Mm-hmm. Whereas I find the difficult part about now, even though I'm only playing senior, you know, the league is really fast paced. We just lost in the Allen Cup final, by the way, a couple nights ago to Dundas.
Well, congratulations to Dundas.
Yes, and Clarenville Caribous. We came second in Canada. Oh, no. Of course, to them first. And but I find it's when you're looking at the D and you don't have the puck, it's those instances you get hit more. So each era has something violent involved. I just find there's more head trauma that's as a result nowadays. And I think it's for those reasons we talked about.
Terry, we got to hustle. And I know you've got a book launch tonight. It is at Shoeless Joe's at 276 King Street West, 7 o'clock Eastern. That is in downtown Toronto. And a plug for the book, and it is an outstanding read. Terry Ryan. Tales of a First Round Nothing. Congrats. I know you've been working on this for a long time. Since the first time we met.
I've been working on that. I didn't even know it was going to be a book. Honestly, that's my journals. There's a lot of what happened in my life, but there's more. So hopefully we sell some of this so we can get Tales of a First Round Nothing too and get the whole Sportsnet crew in here. We'll name them all.
Thanks, bud. Thanks so much for coming by today. Much appreciated. You're a good man.
Good stuff.
And thanks to ECW Press as well for making Terry available. Thanks, bud.
Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it. It couldn't be any better. Good luck, and it's great to see you again.
Thank you, sir, and best of luck when you get back to the Rock. Say hello to all of our good friends, including Todd Gillingham, who I know a little bit on Twitter, Darren Langdon as well, And if you ever get a chance to see Brian Rogers, please send a big
hello. There you
hello
go. He's my Foster Hewitt.
He's a wonderful guy, isn't he?
He certainly is, and he's always got his radio voice going.
It's the best. Yeah. Great call. Thanks, TR.
Okay, thanks, boys.
Talk soon. There he is, Terry Ryan, author of Tales of a First Round Nothing, My Life as an NHL Footnote. Terry Ryan, forward in there by Aaron Asham and Jim Cuddy as well. Jim Cuddy from Blue Rodeo.